Welcome from both the Childhood Brain Tumor Foundation of Maryland and the Children's Brain Tumor Foundation of New York. We're excited to have collaborated together today to bring you this webinar entitled Medulloblastoma. We hope that you find this presentation helpful. Dr. Roger Packer has graciously offered to present information and insights about medulloblastoma. Dr. Packer is Executive Director for the Center for Neuroscience and Behavioral Medicine and the director of both the Brain Tumor Institute and the Jennifer and Daniel Gilbert Neurofibromatosis Institute at the Children's National Medical Center in Washington, D.C. He is dedicated to seeing improvements for children with brain tumors. We welcome Dr. Packer, and thank you for volunteering your time to share this vital information with us.
Hi, my name is Roger Packer, and thank you, Jennifer, for the kind introduction. What we'll be discussing today is childhood medulloblastoma. I will be using some slides that have already been loaded into the system to discuss medulloblastoma, and many of these slides are the same slides that I use in discussions with physicians and other researchers across the country. The main thing I'd like you to take away from the slides are some of the general concepts of medulloblastoma and how they fit into management and hopefully better therapy and outcomes for children. As you can see on this first slide, medulloblastoma is just one of many kinds of different brain tumors that occur in pediatrics. It is the most common malignant brain tumor, and looking at the survival figures that are reported in 1980 compared to what we believe we can accomplish today, you can see that there has been an improvement in survival. For some of our other childhood brain tumors, we can't be as positive about how survival has changed, although in some of those tumors where we have an improved survival, there has been somewhat of an improvement in quality of life. Medulloblastoma, as you turn to the next slide, is the most common malignant brain tumor of childhood and the one with the greatest apparent improvement in survival. This improvement in the survival has been the result of multiple studies done in a stepwise fashion. Many of these studies are cooperative group studies, which means there are studies being done in children all across the United States for the Children's Oncology Group and all across the world in various different groups. Most of these studies are prospective studies, and many of them are randomized studies, meaning that we are looking to try to prove that the therapies we're using are the best. We believe there's also been a change in the quality of life of survivors. In some ways, we believe the quality of life is better, but for some groups, it may not be as beneficial. And the major question I'd like to try to address during the end of this talk is, are we ready for a major transition in care? Can we move to a new era where we're using our better understanding of the molecular biology and genetics of childhood brain tumors into an era where we will provide and first design and then provide therapies around the world that will not only cure more children, but improve their quality of life? So our next slide really lists some of the critical issues that I think we have to think about for all childhood brain tumors, but specifically for medulloblastoma. The first is, has there been a significant increase in our understanding of the neurobiology, genetics, or causations of these tumors? Have these understandings resulted in different or better management? Has there been an improvement in survival? And has there been improvement in the quality of life of survivors? On the next slide, you'll see that medulloblastoma is diagnosed with a variety of different embryonal tumors. Medulloblastoma, for a variety of reasons, are restricted to tumors that only arise in the back lower part of the brain called the posterior fossa. Tumors that occur, which are histologically, which means what they look like under the microscope, similarly in different parts of the brain go by different names and probably do have different biologies. The tumor, as you can see on this next slide, is usually a very fairly characteristic tumor. It contains small cells with minimal tissue around the center of the cell, the nucleus of the cell, called the cytoplasm period. These are called small blue cell tumors. And I think that there's a fairly good consensus about what this tumor is when it looks like this. However, as we turn to the next slide, the whole basis of what medulloblastoma is undergoing a reappraisal. We know that even though the majority of these tumors are these small cell tumors, there are other tumors that have some components of these small cells and then other areas which look different. These different areas have been talked about in different ways. Are they differentiated areas? Are there areas that look even more aggressive, if that's possible, the so-called large cell or anaplastic variant? And as we're moving along in our understanding, we're going from classification from light microscopy to immunohistochemistry to now to molecular genetics. Probably the most important concept is that this is no longer an intellectual exercise. For many years, the actual cell of origin of medulloblastoma was debated. There really is no such cell in the spinal, in the central nervous system as a medulloblast. And now it is with a better understanding of where this cell might come from, I think we know that this could be a key to both better stratification of patients and better management. One of the newer theories about medulloblastoma, as we turn to the next slide, is that medulloblastoma probably comes from a very primitive precursor cell. One of the questions, is that precursor cell a true stem cell? Is it a multipotential precursor? And we know by definition medulloblastoma arises in the cerebellum, which is that posterior structure in the back of the brain, which really acts as a little computer, or not so little computer, but a big computer, to help us with our balance and our coordination. But the cerebellum also has significant roles in speech and in other things as we find more and more about the function of the cerebellum. And the question is, from where in the cerebellum does the tumor arise? And in this next cartoon, you'll see the cerebellum really has two germinal areas, or very primitive areas. One is an area deep within the brain called the germinal matrix, deep in the brain. And then there's a more lateral external granular layer. So we have a ventricular zone deeper in the bowels of the cerebellum and a more laterally placed external granular layer. And there's fairly good evidence now that tumors arise from both areas. The reason that this is important for us is that these tumors may have different makeups. And as we move towards a molecular era, aiming a therapy to one of these kind of molecular makeups will only make sense if the tumor arises from that area and has those molecular targets. And this is something that you'll be hearing more and more about as time goes on. As far as a practical point, the first step in management of medulloblastomas is surgery. Surgery has been shown in multiple studies to be a key element of outcome for children with medulloblastoma. Removing none of the tumor is essentially a death sentence. There have been studies that have shown that extensive resection has been associated with outcome, in that more aggressively or totally or near totally resected patients seem to have a better outcome statistically. However, it's unclear whether this surgery should be done for all patients with medulloblastoma, or whether it would make more sense to do that predominantly in patients who do not have disseminated disease. Because you know in patients with disseminated disease, you can't get all of the tumor out. At the same time, if you leave the majority of the tumor in, it's very difficult to treat the tumor. There's also increasing concern that some of the surgery is causing more damage. This is a side view of the medulloblastoma on the next slide. On your left-hand side is the tumor, which is the lighter gray area in the posterior fossa in the back part of the brain, which presses forwardly against the brainstem and seems to press significantly into the cerebellum. As you can see on the right-hand side with dye, it looks very white. And this is the kind of tumor that seems to be relatively separate from the brainstem that most surgeons would try to do a total resection. And on this MRI scan, we see no evidence of spread of the tumor throughout the brain. And these types of studies, as you see in figure 9C from an old children's oncology group study, shows that those children which would be on the top line who had a total resection, if treated equally, fare better than those children who have a subtotal of less than 90% resection. And this and other data is really why we push to have aggressive surgery done in children with medulloblastoma. The problem, as you see in this next MRI scan, is not all medulloblastomas are alike. This tumor is larger than the one I showed you before. The brainstem, which sits in front of the white area, seems to be invaginated or compressed, and the tumor is much more difficult and actually is higher up in the brain. And one of the issues in this kind of a tumor is how much can be safely taken out. Again, the evidence which suggests that as long as this tumor is not disseminated, taking out more is associated with a better likelihood of survival, but may be result in more morbidity. And in our next slide, we're going to review an entity called the posterior fossa mutism syndrome, which is an increasingly diagnosed syndrome, which is the delayed onset after surgery, usually 6 to 24 hours after surgery, but as long as 48 hours to 72 hours after surgery, where a child who, after a significant surgery for the tumor, is initially talking and then becomes mute. We take a look at this child, and the child has lost muscle tone, has a lot of unsteadiness, both of the trunk, his body, and his arms and his legs, may be inconsolable because of crying, and may have difficulties in swallowing and moving his eyes. Yet when we look at the MRI, we see no specific damage in the brainstem, and we just see that the tumor was removed. Often this tumor was very high, and a significant amount of the middle part of the cerebellum, called the vermis, had to be removed. And this is not just a rare entity. Now nationally, in two recent studies, as for that matter internationally, up to a quarter of children with medulloblastoma after surgery have been diagnosed with this syndrome, with a permanent sequelae probably occurring as high as 50%. Some degree of speech always does come back, but it's not always normal speech. The eyes do get better, but sometimes there's continued impairment, and there's often still a lot of weakness in the body and balance difficulties. It is unclear whether this is just increased recognition or, as many of us are concerned, really an increased incidence because of more postoperative, at least operative-related damage, possibly by being more aggressive and cutting that midline portion of the cerebellum. At this point, however, there's no way to absolutely prevent the syndrome, and sometimes it happens after the fairly small tumors also. Now, the next step after the surgery is separating patients, and this is important because the separating of patients has tremendous implications in what therapy they're going to receive. We really separate patients primarily on whether the tumor is or is not disseminated at the time of diagnosis, and to see that, you have to do an MRI of the brain and spine, preferably before the operation, if you can, to try to avoid any postoperative artifacts, and sample cerebrospinal fluid from the bottom of the back called the lumbar space. That is a little bit risky unless you remove the tumor, but after the tumor is removed, as long as there's no hydrocephalus, it's a safe procedure. With these two major determinants, patients are predominantly broken into either average risk disease that can be treated with radiation alone, but now in this era, radiation and some form of chemotherapy, or poor or high-risk disease that need to have radiation, probably at a higher dose, with even more aggressive chemotherapy. Infants and young children really don't fit particularly well into this because of our understanding of the disease. Most of them are considered high-risk, although even in that group there seems to be a subgroup of medulloblastomas that seem to behave better. This is what an MRI of the spine looks like in a child with metastatic disease. Behind the vertebral bodies, along the spine, you can see those little white dots, and that is spread of tumor. That kind of spread of tumor occurs in anywhere from 20 to 30% of patients with medulloblastoma, even higher in infants, and less in older patients and young adults. This is the major classification or stratification system that we've used for the past 3 decades. Again, the average risk group is localized, has a near total resection. By definition, all medulloblastomas occur in the back of the brain, the posterior fossa. And in general, people only consider older patients as average risk disease, where the younger babies or the patients with disseminated disease or the partially resected patients are considered to have more extensive disease. Now, one of the things that we've learned the hard way, and this next slide is reviewing a study called A9961 that I chaired for the Children's Oncology Group, is that even though we believe that this is a fairly straightforward stratification, when you look at it, it isn't as straightforward, because looking at 400 consecutively evaluated patients, almost a quarter of patients had scans that were either misread at their local institution and had dissemination, and they were missed at their local institution, or the scans were not done appropriately. So one thing that's extremely important is to make sure that the MRIs are done appropriately and reviewed by people experienced in reviewing these MRI scans. Because putting the patients on a study where they have reduced dose treatment, as you've seen in this event-free survival from A9961, the next slide, if you put those patients who have missed disease that are disseminated on this kind of study, the survival rate is much poorer, which is that lower purple line sitting at about 40% at 5 years, compared to the almost 90% survival for this kind of reduced dose therapy for patients who truly have totally resected non-disseminated tumors. Another area where people are looking at very hard to add to stratification is what does the tumor look like under the microscope. As we discussed previously, by looking under light microscopy, there are areas that may even look more aggressive. This has been called the large cell or anaplastic variant. And at this point, we are considering most patients with a great deal of anaplasia to have poor risk disease, even if the tumor is totally resected and non-disseminated. This has not been completely, conclusively proven, but the results of the two most recent Children's Oncology Group studies strongly suggest that this is the case. And this is one such plot from one of those curves, event-free survival for those patients with no anaplasia on their MRI, or for that matter, a little bit of on their histology sections, compared to those who have significant anaplasia, and you see about a 20% difference in overall survival with patients treated equally on the study. There are a variety of new molecular markers. This is a marker called TRAC-C or tyrosine kinase C that was looked at by both Dr. Pomeroy in Boston and Dr. Grotzer when he was in Philadelphia. And there are a variety of different newer markers that will be incorporated soon, these molecular markers, to help even better separate patients out. Another marker is called ERBB, which is part of the epidermal growth factor receptor complex. And here, high ERBB suggests a poor outcome. And even another marker that people are looking at is the MYC marker. And again, high MYC shows poor outcome. And then if you get really fancy and you do a multi-genetic plot and try to figure out predictors of those patients who do well or do less well, you can also on a molecular basis now, at least in retrospect, separate out patients. I think in the future, and I hope it's going to be the near future, we will be able to separate out patients with medulloblastoma even better to try to figure out what is favorable prognosis and unfavorable prognosis, merging the information we have about how extensive the disease is and how much it's been removed to a variety of different molecular markers. This is being tried now in the Children's Oncology Group, and at this point we don't have the data to know how predictive it's going to be for all the patients. And we also don't know if we can do this in real time meaning getting the information to the doctors so they can decide which treatment arm the child should go on. But I'm sure as the biology gets more exact and the techniques get faster, that we'll be able to provide this, I hope, within the next 3 to 5 years. Thus, if we take a look at where we are with separation of patients, we certainly have better neural imaging. One of the things that this may have resulted in more patients being pushed to the high-risk group if the imaging is done well. I think that's very important. It may have the interesting effect of making our high-risk group seem to have better survival because we're putting somewhat less aggressive tumors in there, and at the same time make our low-risk group look even better because we're separating out even borderline patients, but that's still to be proven. Unfortunately, the neuroimaging is not as standardized as we'd like, and we need to incorporate these molecular markers. And ultimately, I believe that we will have an intermediary risk group that will receive therapy, someone between what we do for average risk patients and lower and higher risk patients. Radiotherapy is the next step in the treatment of medulloblastoma, and as you can see on the next slide, it is really the backbone of effective treatment for older patients. Now, where older patients occur is a bit unclear. Children who are less than 3 often are started with chemotherapy, although in some centers less than 4 or even less than 5. Unfortunately, the results with chemotherapy, as we'll show you, are not nearly as good as using the radiation. The necessary evil is that the radiation has to be given to the entire brain and spine, even in patients where we can't prove dissemination, because of the concern that these tumor cells are very smart and hide in crevices in the brain and spine, and we can't determine, at least at this point, by MRI or by spinal fluid analysis. For adults with medulloblastoma, radiation is often used alone because the adults do not tolerate the chemotherapy as well. There is some question in maybe some subsets of medulloblastoma that we might be able to use radiation only locally, although we have to have a better biologic handle before we do that. And there are a couple of new techniques that may make radiation a bit less toxic. Certainly the posterior fossa radiation now can be more limited with the techniques, which is the boost area. There is a technique called proton beam that delivers less radiation to surrounding organs, which is of some advantage, especially in very young children, trying to guard those organs. And one of the things we have learned with radiation is that for children with non-disseminated disease, if we look at them carefully and pick them out carefully, we can reduce the dose of radiation therapy. This is a cartoon given to me by the group in Boston, looking at the difference in the scatter radiation of regular x-rays to the spine as compares to proton beam. As you can see in the picture, less of the bowel and kidney and other areas in the body, including the lungs and heart, radiation is given to those areas with proton beam. However, to the brain, there really isn't a tremendous advantage to the proton beam. One of the first approaches used to see if we could reduce radiation for children with medulloblastoma was a cut-in radiation to the brain and spine by a third, performed by the forerunners of the Children's Oncology Group, the Children's Cancer Group, and the Pediatric Oncology Group in the late 1980s and early 1990s. In this study, no chemotherapy was given. And unfortunately, it was found that as far as early relapse, meaning relapse in the first 5 years, as you can see on this study, in the first 3 years, as you see on this study, children who received the reduced doses of radiation fared less well. However, when you followed the group out to 5 years, the difference between the two curves was minimal. This was quite disappointing. Although the differences aren't as marked, it does seem that children will fail earlier if all you do is reduce the dose of radiation. However, then the era and the thoughts on medulloblastoma changed, and through a variety of different studies, it started looking like the addition of chemotherapy was of some survival benefit for patients. and seem to improve survival by 20% to 30% overall. This statement has to be taken, has to be at least analyzed carefully, because there have been no direct studies that have compared higher doses to lower dose chemotherapy plus lower dose radiotherapy plus chemotherapy. However, some of us are not convinced that these studies are ethical at this point to expose children to higher doses of radiation when you don't need to. Also, we don't want to take a step back in the way we manage these patients. But a variety of studies have shown this 20 to 30% improvement in survival. And now chemotherapy is considered standard in children with medulloblastoma. And the sequencing of the chemotherapy into radiation is of critical importance, with the best survival rates being noted if the radiation is not delayed, but is given prior to and during radiation. Chemotherapy prior to and during radiation with no delay in radiation. And almost as importantly as the improving survival, it has allowed us to reduce the dose of craniospinal radiation and hopefully improve survival at the same time as we decrease sequelae. The first study to probably show this was a study that I was able to perform with collaborators in Philadelphia and in Washington, looking at radiation plus three drugs, CCNU, vincristine, and cisplatin. And even in this study, which we did in the late 1980s, we reduced the dose of craniospinal radiation in younger patients. And these were the results on the next slide that were almost surprising to us. The doses of the children who were not disseminated at the time of diagnosis, even if they received reduced dose radiation, had nearly a 90% survival. In prior studies being done at that time, most studies showed only a 50 to 60% survival rate, and that's probably the best you can do with radiation, maybe as high as 65% if you use radiation alone. For the children with metastatic disease, which is a lower bar, they didn't fare as well, but you can see that even in that group, 60 to 70% in a small series were surviving. This led to a prospective phase 3 study performed through the Children's Oncology Group, utilizing one of two chemotherapy regimens, but all the chemotherapy, again, being done during and after radiation. And the results of this study that has been published in over 400 children show that with the addition of chemotherapy to reduce doses of radiation therapy, we can see at this point and between an 80 and 90% likelihood of long-term survival, and for many of the children, cure of medulloblastoma, which is a major advance to where we were 20 years ago. And that is both an event-free survival, as I showed you before, and overall survival for the group. This has led to a variety of different studies. There's another study that's been published to the St. Jude's group, utilizing higher-dose chemotherapy in a slightly shorter time frame, and this is the drugs that they utilize, which really are high-dose therapy with peripheral stem cell rescue, and show very similar results between an 80 and 90% overall survival rate, with the high-risk patients sitting again at the 60 to 65%. This, again, is more proof that we could potentially reduce the dose of craniospinal radiation and give chemotherapy and get excellent survival rates. Now, the difficulty with this study is that it is using higher-dose chemotherapy, which is theoretically of more risk to the patients. It is also using quite a bit of cyclophosphamide that may cause sterility with long-term use, especially in young patients. But the positive is it uses less cisplatin, and the therapy is given over a shorter period of time, 4 to 6 months instead of a year after the radiation. And this is the regimen that they use. Now, one of the interesting studies was done by the German group, which is on this slide, where they used radiotherapy, but they randomized between either using the chemotherapy first and then followed by radiation therapy about 3 to 4 months later, or going right to radiotherapy with the regimen that we developed in Philadelphia and Washington. And you can see in this study that those children who received more intensive chemotherapy but used it before radiation had a worse survival, which is the lower arm, compared to those children who had received the radiation therapy immediately and got the chemotherapy during and after radiation. And this and a couple of other studies have really suggested strongly that patients should not have a delay of their radiation therapy. So as we look forward for the use of chemotherapy for medulloblastoma, we still haven't defined clearly which is the best regimen, although many of them give very good survival rates. We also don't really know what the best regimen is for the higher risk patients, which we'll talk about later. But we do believe that the chemotherapy should be given with radiation, although we have to look carefully at potential additive toxicities, such as hearing problems with cisplatin, the neuropathies, the weakness in the arms and legs, which are usually reversible with vincristine. And if we use cyclophosphamide, the issue of increased hormonal problems, especially sterility. One of the questions that has always been raised, and it's been sort of looked at in this slide, comparing three different studies, is as we've reduced craniospinal radiation, do we have more children failing outside the primary site? And the answer really is probably not. Even the most recent UKCCG study, which is in the first column, shows that dissemination occurs in about 3/4 of patients who fail original treatment, which is similar to what we found in the most recent large children's oncology group study. I think it's the biology of the tumor that drives whether you're going to fail outside the primary site in a disseminated fashion. And at this point, we are very supportive of trying to even further reduce radiation therapy. So as we take a look at where we are in average risk medulloblastoma, I think that survival is now relatively acceptable, but not perfect. It's about an 80 to 90% survival rate if patients get treated with radiation and chemotherapy. Different protocols have shown about the same ability to control disease with probably different toxicities. The major difference is if chemotherapy is used after radiotherapy, it seems more successful than using the chemotherapy before radiation therapy. And we really have to continue to try to balance for these children with non-disseminated disease the likelihood of survival versus the likelihood of sequelae. We, in the early 1990s, opened the study even further, reducing the dose of craniospinal radiation to 1,800 CGY. This study was stopped after the first 10 patients because we saw 3 early relapses. In retrospect, this was probably a bad decision given that those relapses by chance could have been the 3 out of the next 20. We just don't know. All we do know is we followed the other 7 patients who got the reduced doses of craniospinal radiation, and we had no other failures, and their IQs are remarkably good at follow-up. This data and the increasing data through the Children's Oncology Group from the A9961 study has led us to a new national study reducing in a randomized fashion for the youngest patients, those between 3 and 7, radiation from 2340 down to 1800, which is 50% of what we gave 25 years ago. And in those children who are older, we are looking at a question of whether we can reduce the dose of radiation therapy to the, not reduce the dose, but reduce the volume of radiation, I'm sorry, to the posterior fossa and try to spare some critical structures. So this study, which is now open, is randomizing the younger children to a reduced dose or full dose of craniospinal radiation and either a standard volume or a reduced volume of radiation to the posterior fossa by conformal techniques. And once again, for the older children, is randomizing between the 2 volumes of radiation. And as in other studies, vincristine continues to be given during radiation therapy, and chemotherapy is being given after radiation. The next step in the discussion of medulloblastoma is what do we do with the children with poor risk disease, those children who have disseminated tumors, as you can see on this slide. And here, the survival rates have not been nearly as promising in some studies, especially some of the studies that have used pre-radiation chemotherapy. This is a study from the UKCCG, the United Kingdom, which shows only about a 40% survival rate for those patients. However, as we've shown you earlier in the St. Jude studies, and even in the old studies done in Philadelphia and Washington that I ran, that the addition of chemotherapy following immediate radiation, full dose of radiation, has a significant number of survivors, possibly in the 65 to 70% range. This is a slide from my old study. And there have been other studies that have looked at that. There's a study done by the Pediatric Oncology Group that has not yet been published, but is out in abstract form, that has shown a similar survival rate. As we take a look at these poor-risk children with medulloblastoma, we believe that with some of the newer ways we're treating it, that this diagnosis is not a death sentence, that approximately 60 to 70% of children can survive. These children need craniospinal radiation at relatively high dose and probably also need chemotherapy at relatively high dose. There's another study looking at more aggressive chemotherapy during radiation with a drug called carboplatinum and seeing that adds to survival. That's a Children's Oncology Group study. There are other studies utilizing higher dose chemotherapy. Unfortunately, as we raise the doses of radiation to back to the conventional doses and add chemotherapy, we don't know if we're worsening overall quality of life by causing more neurocognitive problems. However, it has to be made clear that disseminated disease does not mean that the disease is ultimately going to relapse. Some will, but approximately two-thirds of children will survive with present treatment, although there are clearly some subsets of patients that are resistant to treatment. The present poor-risk study being done through the Children's Oncology Group is randomizing between carboplatinum with radiation and no carboplatinum with radiation, and it's also doing the second randomization, looking at a new biologic agent, retinoic acid, where half the children will receive it in maintenance and half will not. And this is an agent that, at least in neuroblastoma, has improved survival by inducing more cells to go through programmed cell death. As we look at what happens to these children as they survive, one of the questions that families always ask is, is my child going to have a relapse late? The majority of the relapses in children with medulloblastoma occur in the first 2 years. There are some children who relapse late, but the relapse rate after receiving radiation and chemotherapy is relatively low, probably 1 in 20 to 1 in 50. When we look at what's happened in some of these follow-up protocols, another thing we have to look at carefully as children get older is whether they pick up new tumors, and we have seen 6 or 7 tumors out of the 400 greater than 5 years later. Some of them have been relatively benign, but some, like a glioblastoma multiforme, have been terrible tumors and will cause death. But overall, the majority of children who survive 5 years will continue to maintain that disease control for quite a period of time. And as we take a look at the survival in these studies, as we look at merging all of the different studies, is the survival, unfortunately, after relapse of medulloblastoma is quite poor. So one of the things we have to push hard is to try to get the most effective therapy in the beginning. If children relapse, although some can be salvaged, the majority, 75 to 80%, will ultimately die of their disease. So as we summarize, the addition of chemotherapy has improved survival, although some of that improvement in survival may be because we classify more children as high risk and less children as low risk. That the biologic advances have been impressive but have yet not been incorporated into therapy. And that outcome as far as quality of life is not clearly better yet. For infants, there's no consistent definition of who is too young for radiation. Non-randomized comparisons have suggested some improved survival with more aggressive therapy. This has been predominantly seen in non-disseminated patients. And with the removal of a very difficult tumor type that we didn't know about until recently, the atypical teratoid rhabdoid tumor, from therapy. This is a child with medulloblastoma. This is a CT scan of a child diagnosed in 1982 when I was in Philadelphia. This is how much tumor was actually left after surgery. After one cycle of very fairly what would be now considered weak chemotherapy, the tumor disappeared. The child finished a year's worth of chemotherapy, never saw radiation, and is alive well over 20 years later with no evidence of recurrent disease and normal intellect. Unfortunately, we treated 9 more patients with the same therapy, and they all relapsed and died. So what we've learned over the years for chemotherapy for infants is that a variety of different regimens, be it this 4-drug regimen that has been called baby POG, or an intensification of this regimen, will, as in this study where the German group added methotrexate to higher dose chemotherapy, these kind of regimens can result in long-term survival for a subset of patients. There was this study, the HIP 1992, the German study that added methotrexate, had some very impressive survival rates. However, as we drilled down to the data, the majority of the survivors were in a subset of children with medulloblastoma and infants called the desmoplastic variant. And for children who had disseminated disease, they didn't fare nearly as well. And this is a pictorial of separating these two children groups treated just with chemotherapy, be it an aggressive chemotherapy. Now, the other problem with this study is if you take a look at the quality of life or developmental outcome of those children, children did have significant drops, even though they never saw radiation, probably due to the methotrexate they received. So when we take a look at what we're trying to do with infant medulloblastoma in the future, a study that's been recently completed that we don't have the results of, are trying to use chemotherapy, and then trying to make sure with second-look surgery that the tumor is gone, and if there's no evidence of dissemination, trying to come in with localized radiation. So one approach is to use more localized radiation in non-disseminated tumors. A second approach is to use even more aggressive chemotherapy to try to avoid radiation in some children, especially those with desmoplastic tumors, and reduce the dose of radiation in those children who have non-desmoplastic tumors. However, as we take a look, it doesn't seem that the protocols are the driving factor, but more the biology of the tumor. A variety of different protocols have shown similar response rate. There is some evidence that maybe some of the more aggressive protocols are a little bit better, but the outcome major predictor remains biology of these tumors. And this is a pictorial of multiple different studies, with at least 2 of them on the right-hand side showing some very good survival rates, but we're not sure how many of those patients have the desmoplastic tumors and how many had the standard treatment. In the desmoplastic tumors, it seems that up to 70% of children, if not more, can be treated with chemotherapy alone, whereas the children with the more classical medulloblastoma do not have nearly as good a survival rate. And this is sort of where we are with childhood infant malignant tumors. We want to separate out the desmoplastic tumors and maybe treat them less aggressively. We really need to get better treatment for children with disseminated disease. Now, as we end up with this discussion, I do want to put this in perspective, that we are looking now in an era where 60, 70, maybe in subsets, 80% of children survive, many cured. But these children have multiple long-term issues in their thinking and hormonal function, in neurologic function, the risk of secondary tumors, their quality of life, their independence in the future. And through a lot of different studies, including a study called the Children's Cancer Survivor Study that I'm the chair of the Neurologic Committee, we've noted that these children have many more deficits than maybe we really even knew. We've known for years that if you take a look at a scatter diagram of children's IQs before and after treatment with radiation, that children after full-dose radiation who are less than 7 or 5 will drop any between 20 and 30 IQ points by 2 years to 3 years. And even in the older patients, there is some drop in function, if not always in IQ. And IQ remains a poor measure of what's happening to these children, so Some have selective problems with attention. Many have selective problems with learning new information. But it does give us a minor handle on the problems these children have. And we looked at the Children's Cancer Survivor study. It was very sobering. 10 to 20% have significant long-term neurologic dysfunction, including unsteadiness and weakness. 10 to 20% have problems with their vision or their hearing. And it's not clear whether this is improving with modern treatment. Yes, we've reduced the dose of radiation, which should help with cognition, but we've added drugs like cisplatin, which may hurt your hearing. And as we reported earlier to you in this talk, we're seeing more and more of the posterior fossa mutism syndrome. I think our real hope for the future is to try to replace both radiation and chemotherapy ultimately with more selective targeted treatment. And this enters the era of, can we use our biologic information to help more children with medulloblastoma? This is a slide given to me by Dr. McDonald from our group in Washington, showing that children with medulloblastoma who have disseminated disease have a different biologic makeup than those children who do not have disseminated disease in their tumors. And can we exploit that different biologic makeup to develop ideas about what pathways are activated in those children with metastatic or more aggressive disease and target those pathways? That's where the future needs to be. And Dr. McDonald and our group has postulated a metastatic pathway of certain growth factors such as epidermal growth factor, platelet-derived growth factor upregulated, that this pathway then goes down from the cell surface through the cell to different circuits to promote tumor growth and spread. And probably, and as importantly as identifying the pathway, we now know that there are certain inhibitors of a variety of different parts of this pathway which can be targeted, and the drugs are already in clinical trials in adults and in some in pediatrics that might be helpful in the future, as shown on this card too. But the incorporation of biologic agents, which you see on this slide, has been frustratingly slow. Which patients should be treated is a real issue. Should they be treated, should these therapies be used alone? Do they need to be lumped together, hitting multiple targets so we don't allow the cell to get smart and escape the drugs? Do they need to be used with chemotherapy and with radiation therapy? And how do you choose the most effective drugs, since many of the drugs will really only slow the disease but not completely cure it? And as I said, retinoic acid, which is a maturation agent, is already in trial, and other drugs will be going into trial very soon in newly diagnosed patients, and they are already in trial in children with relapsed disease. So as we take a look of the future, there are many challenges for children with medulloblastoma. Even with standard conventional therapy, we have issues with the consistency of basic neuroimaging, the consistency of histologic diagnosis, the consistency of stopping rules for chemotherapy, and even some people who are still pushing to use chemotherapy before radiation. And we don't really absolutely know how we should approach this 25% incidence of surgical complications. We have significant challenges in quality of life. We have to start identifying which patients are at highest risk for these kind of damaging effects of radiation and chemotherapy, and tailor their treatment to try to avoid that if possible. We have to develop more cost-effective ways to follow patients for these problems so that we can identify them early and get interventions to patients as early as possible. And we've got to figure out new ways to remediate these problems. We have to incorporate our molecular genetic findings into standard care. We have to identify those at risk and modify treatment accordingly. Maybe for some, we're not going to use radiation alone. That's part of the hope. For some, maybe we can use less chemotherapy. And clearly, what we like to do is avoid craniospinal radiation. As we incorporate our biologic agents in the therapies, as we said, we've got to decide which agents, which pathways are going to hit. We want to try to tailor that therapy to the type of medulloblastoma that the patient has and use a more effective biologic target. So as we look at the future, we have made progress, but the progress isn't exactly where we want it to be. There's a lot of challenges, but I think for families taking care of these patients, having these children, and for doctors taking care of these patients, we really want them to be optimistic. The majority of patients will survive, and by working together, we'll hopefully not only have survivors, but survivors with excellent qualities of life. Thank you very much for allowing me to share some of these thoughts, and I hope this is helpful. I'm going to give this back to Jennifer for some closing remarks. Thank you. Bye-bye.
On behalf of the Children's Brain Tumor Foundation of New York and the Childhood Brain Tumor Foundation of Maryland, thank you for sharing your time and knowledge with us, Dr. Packer. We appreciate your time and dedication.
Thank you.